out, and it's only moving 6,000 miles an hour, not 17,500. So anything that's in orbit around a point source of mass, the Earth is considered a point source of mass as far as your satellite is concerned. Anything that is in going in orbit around a point source of mass, obeying the laws of gravity, inverse square law, and you get this very similar inverse square law when it comes to electrostatic attraction of protons and electrons inside of an atom. So there's a strong similarity there, although one is electrostatic and one is gravity. But in any case, the closer in orbits have to move faster, the further out orbits have to move slower. Slower in velocity, slower in angular rate, no matter how you rate it. And you look at a galaxy and you expect the thing to be winding up like a spring. The center should be spinning real fast and the outer perimeter should be spinning real slow. And the galaxy does not do that. The whole thing spins as one great big wheel. The center is spinning a little bit faster, but not much. In order for that velocity profile to exist, there has to be a hell of a lot of mass with a very specific distribution across that galaxy to allow Kepler's laws to give you that particular velocity profile. There's got to be a hell of a lot of dark matter. Maybe it's dust. And that dark matter, up till now, has not revealed itself as emitting any particular wavelength that the optical and radio astronomy and ultraviolet telescopes have seen. So whatever dark matter is, we're calling it dark because it has no emission, no absorption. It is not making its presence known by any other way except that it's got to have the mass and gravity of that dark matter in order for that galaxy to obey those Keplerian laws to rotate the way it does. So lots and lots of evidence. Every single galaxy has got a whole lot of dark matter which hasn't been seen. So if it was part of a molecule, that molecule would emit differently than it does in the laboratory. Question. Yeah, go ahead, Bill West.
Can an electron that is stationary in a magnetic field be set into the motion by the magnetic field? Compare a contrast to the behavior of an electron in an electric field.
And whenever we talk about these molecules, we make an extremely simple model. It's like a solar system. We got the nucleus in the center, which represents the sun, and we got these electrons going around, which represent the planet. And any of the good references you go to say that's a beginning of an understanding of the molecule. The real electrons are moving in much, much more complicated patterns. So the word stationary electron is almost a...
No, I'm talking about that electron is in the stationary state in the magnetic field. Could then this electron be set into the motion by the magnetic field? So we would like to compare and contrast the behavior of an electron in that electric field.
Yeah, I was going to try to go there, but by a circuitous route, Wes. The word free electron, non-moving electron, is almost an oxymoron. It's almost a set of words that don't have real meaning. Can you make an electron sit still?
Yes, they can.
All right, I'm going to give you that. I think it's very difficult. And when the electron, which has got a huge amount of charge compared to its diameter, it's a very low charge, 10 to the minus 19 coulombs, but compared to its diameter, its charge to mass ratio is huge. When that charge moves through a magnetic field, and if there's any portion of the magnetic field, any vector component of the magnetic field that's at right angles to the velocity. Let me backtrack. If the magnetic field was parallel to the velocity of the electron, there is no interaction of any kind. If there is a portion of the magnetic field tilted compared to that velocity, then you're definitely going to get a force and you get a deflection of the electron. So the moving charge in the presence of a magnetic field does create a deflecting force. To my knowledge, the charge of an electron in a steady state magnetic field applies no force to the the electron. Now, the next question you're going to ask is, if the magnetic field is moving, now the word moving has got at least two to three different meanings. Now, I mean, everything here is relative. Whether I move the electron compared to the magnetic field, or the magnetic field moves compared to the electron, in either case, I'm going to create a force. So, if I have a magnetic field that has a velocity to it, I'm going to get a force.
So your answer is yes or no?
The magnetic field was moving. If I've got a C-shaped magnet, and I sweep it with my arm from left to right, and somewhere in the middle of that path there was an electron, I've now moved the magnetic field with reference to the charge of that electron. Yes, I'm going to create a force. So if one moves compared to the other, I'm going to get a force. But now if the magnetic field is not moving, but it's only changing in magnitude, it's an electromagnet, and I'm now making the magnetic field get stronger or weaker, will that create a force? I think the answer might be no. So I think you can move an electron with a magnetic field only if the magnetic field has a velocity to it. There's got to be a relative velocity between the electron and the magnetic field. That's my belief. This is not my area of strength. There's a good chance here I'm wrong. And we'll, in the coming weeks, we'll find out about this. N2XJN, wait for the four beeps. K2RIW.
KC2QAQ with a comment.
Okay, Wes first and then Glenn, in that order. Go ahead, Wes.
Well, in order to experience a force, the electron has to be moving. If it is in rest, it will experience no force. So as a result, a magnetic field cannot set the electron into the motion. And it's the first law, Newton's law. So in the electric field, however, the electron experiences the force, if I remember correctly, F equals the minus EE. And so it will be accelerated. A equals EEM. I don't know how to say it properly. I know it from the school. Whether it is in rest or already moving. But this is the proper answer. But do you?
I'm going to agree. The way you and I were taught says that when the electron is moving and there is at right angles to it a magnetic field, there's going to be a force that follows the XYZ, the right-hand rule. There's going to be a force exerted that's going to deflect the electron. The electron is moving with reference to a fixed magnetic field. What happens if I reverse it? If the electron is not moving, but the magnetic field is moving, there's still a relative motion between the two. The moving magnetic field around that stationary electron, I say, is going to create a right-angle force. Let's see if Glenn feels that way. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Well, I guess the thing here is that when we talk about charge, electrons, electricity, we have mass. So we have electrical circuits, we've got a conductor, we have electrons. Magnetic fields don't require electrons. As a matter of fact, a magnetic wave doesn't require electrons in it, doesn't require mass. It's not in its units. So when you look at, when you're discussing a magnetic field and an electric field, the magnetic field must be around the electric field. So in other words, you're looking at the right-hand rule here. So if you have an electron in the wire or a current flow of motion at that point in time, and then you have the field around the outside, and then you can basically relate the magnetic field to the electron flow or current that in that wire. But basically, if you have an AC wave and basically just a change in flux density in free space, there's no mass required, so there's no electron. So you just have to make sure that you treat the electron with the electric field. It's not really directly associated to the magnetic field. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You may have another question.
Yeah, let's not leave this one yet, because there's a lot going on here. Will you admit, Glenn, that I cannot make an electromagnet without making a current flow? Let's see if you agree with that one first. Go ahead.
I sure do.
Okay, so it takes a moving charge, a moving electrons, to make an electromagnet have magnetic field. Okay. Now let's go over to a steady state magnetic structure. Isn't it possible that a permanent magnet has at the atomic level an alignment of those electrons flowing around those nucleuses, so that there still is a moving charge creating that steady state magnetic field? Is that possible, Glenn? Go ahead.
There must be a moving electrical charge in order for there to be a magnetic field. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so if I include the... Let it drop. If I include things at the atomic level, now can we say more safely that every magnetic field is created by the motion of electrons? Now, I know that there's a way that the nucleus can do something to make a magnetic field. I'm left to believe, and I'm not sure I'm right on this one, that the orbit of the electrons being aligned in their axes is what makes a permanent magnet. I think the majority of the magnetic field in our permanent magnets is the alignment of the orbits of the electrons around those atoms and molecules. That's my belief. And if that's true, then every magnetic field really was created by electrons moving somewhere, that without electrons moving, we don't have a magnetic field. And we're talking now at the atomic level, but still electrons are moving. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're talking about a static, you know, right-hand rule, and you're looking at basically that you have to have a movement of charge to create a current flow to create the magnetic field, at least the static magnetic field, you must have that current constantly moving. If it's not moving, there's no magnetic field, so in the steady state. But here again, if you create the wave at that particular point, the electrons aren't even necessary anymore. So really the electron and the mass is really a function of the electrical charge part of the equation. But when you're talking about the magnetic field, it's just basically an additional force at right hand to the electrical charge. So only in the steady state do you really have the direct relationship between the electron and the magnetic field.
WHYY.
And Wesley, question.
Yeah, Joe and Wesley in that order. But before I go to either one of you guys, we've now got a problem. Wesley's original question, if I've got a steady state electron and I'm doing something with the magnetic field, can I create a force? I think the answer is yes. I said yes if I move the magnetic field. Now, I can physically take a C-shaped, horseshoe-shaped magnet and physically move it across a chunk of space where there's an electron, and I know that the relative motion of electron and magnetic field is going to create a force. I believe that's what a railgun does. A railgun creates electronically a moving magnetic field. You've got a whole bunch of individual magnets and electromagnets, and you fire them in sequence, but by the firing of them in sequence of that railgun, I'm making a moving magnetic field. The moving magnetic field, yes, it's using eddy currents of the projectile, but at the molecular level of those eddy currents, I am creating a force on those electrons. So a moving magnetic field, I think by way of the proof of a railgun, does create a force on an electron. See if you agree with that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Absolutely, especially if that electron is part of a conductor and you move that that magnetic field 90 degrees to that structure of let's say copper atoms, and you move it 90 degrees within it, yes, it's going to interfere with it, and it's going to move it. Absolutely. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So Wesley's original question is, with a magnetic field, can I apply a force to a stationary electron by way of the railgun? And he wanted to know yes or no. I think the answer is yes. If I do the right thing with a magnetic field, I can apply a force to an electron. A railgun does that. Okay, Joe wanted to ask something. WHYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Hi, good evening, WHYY. Fascinating discussion. I wanted to ask a question on something else. I checked in actually late, so I missed probably part of the space report. Was there any information or anything mentioned about that asteroid that's supposed to be coming near planet Earth, and if that will be viewable from this area at all on November 8th?
Yeah, I hope Paul is still with us. Let me wait for the beep. Yeah, Paul said he's still here. And by the way, when you talk through the machine, Paul, the first 2 seconds don't come through. I'm hearing you on the input. Tell us about that asteroid. You gave us a report, and I was busy doing something else, and I didn't pay enough attention to it. So repeat the asteroid report of your space report, Paul. WS2M, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yes. This is a newsworthy type of a report. All the news stations do have it. But it is coming relatively close to the Earth. The moon is a quarter of a million miles out, probably 250,000 miles out. So here's this asteroid coming along, cutting an arc through that orbit of the moon. And, you know, it's not going to be here long, roughly about 2 days. If you had a telescope good enough to look at it, it would be, 180-degree view over 2 days. It would be gone, you know, from one end to the other. Not orbiting the Earth, but, almost like just like a straight line, like a straight line crossing the orbit of the moon. So within inside the orbit of the moon. So that's relatively close. The thing is, we have better detecting methods now. You transmit out and you get these pictures of this asteroid that's 1,000 feet across. The news reports it the size of an aircraft carrier. Okay, so I'm going to call it 1,000 feet across. What was I going to say about it? These things have probably come this close before, you know, hundreds of years in the past. Let me drop it. Thousands of years into the past, but it's only recently that we have the able, you know, to detect things this small, you know, at that kind of a range. So, you know, they have pictures of it now. All right. If you go to, best thing you could do is go to the NASA site, and I believe that's still up as one of the main things that you see. You go to www.nasa.gov, and the homepage will come up, and they always have a half a dozen main topics, and I believe that's still one of the main topics, if not the main topic. And they'll even show you the orbit of it, and they'll give you the whole story, you know, in relative detail. But it's pretty good. I mean, if this thing was to hit the Earth, you'd be in big trouble. But it's not going to do that. And they have predictions from its orbit many hundreds of years out, and they know that within hundreds of years from now, it's not going to come close to the Earth. It'll come around, around and around again, but it's not going to be hitting the Earth. If you live through, 300 or 400 years from now, you probably still won't see this thing hit the Earth. Back to that WS2N.
Do you have a velocity on it?
Yeah, I can't. I don't remember it, John. I don't remember it. I think it's, I read it, and I don't remember it, John, but I'm going to guess probably in the 50,000 mile per hour range, that area, but I can't remember.
Yeah, there's a website called Space Weather. At the bottom of their page, it's a http://, no www, just spaceweather.com. At the bottom of that first page, they've always got this thing called, here it is, what do they call it now? Near Earth asteroid. And they're saying this particular near Earth asteroid will pass by us closest distance on November 8th, 0.8 lunar distance, and the object is 400 meters in diameter. So It's a 400-meter diameter object, 0.4 kilometer. 0.8 lunar distance is how close it's going to get to the Earth on November 8th. So I finally found that particular website, and I guess we can click on that and get some further information. Is that the one that we're talking about, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
That's it, yeah, 0.8. Just what's inside the lunar orbit, you know, that's the way they draw it up on the diagram, you know. In other words, if you had a show a circumference, you know, all the way around, and then you have this the arc of the moon, and you put a chord, geometric chord, from one end to the other, it's going to last that distance for no more than 2 days. So you can figure that out, you know, 24 hours. Let's say one end of to the other. What's the diameter of the lunar orbit? You know, and you could divide that by 2 days, by 48 hours, and you can figure out the miles per hour. But they give it somewhere, the relative speed. My guess is about, they're usually about 50,000 miles per hour, you know, the near Earth. You know, asteroids or, you know, anything that comes by us is usually about 15,000 miles per hour. Back to you, Dick.
Joe, when you go to that page called spaceweather.com, and at the bottom are the near-Earth asteroids, and then you see this one that's 0.8 lunar distance, and on November 8th, and you click on it, it'll open up a page of Jet Propulsion Laboratory, called Solar System Dynamics. They will show you a three-dimensional orbital diagram of where that asteroid is. And imagine if we go to the right diagram, we'll actually see where will the moon be, where will the Earth be as this thing goes whizzing by. And be happy that these things don't strike the Earth. Something 400 meters in diameter at its kind of velocity striking the Earth would, in my opinion, be a very significant event. So maybe that's what the information you were looking for, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. Yes, that is what I was looking for. Spaceweather.com. I think that's what you said.
You've got it, Joe. No www, just http://spaceweather.com. At the bottom of that page, you'll see the near-Earth asteroids all listed. Near-Earth objects, and when you find the one which is about five lines down, and it's got a purple mark across it, you click on the left-hand side of that purple mark, and it'll open up the page for you for NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a page called Solar System Dynamics, and it'll show you the orbital diagram of that object. You have to have a particular particular program loaded in so that you can get that diagram, and it automatically loaded that diagram for me right now. So need a fill on that, Joe? Back to you, Joe.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that'll do it. I'll go check that out and see what that's all about. Thanks. K2RW in the net, W2RYY.
And Wesley with a question.
And Joe, mostly recognized. Joe, how did you find out about this? How did you first know that this particular asteroid exists?
I heard it mentioned on Fox News, on cable TV, a couple of days ago.
And WS2N, one comment.
Okay, let's pick up Wesley in that order. Wesley and then Paul. Go ahead, Wes.
I have one more scientific question, and since we start with the forest calls, and then I'm going to ask Glenn. He was helping me a lot, but I want that half as a recording for quite interested group of people. That would be the second question. So the first question is a charged particle passing through the certain region of space. has a velocity which magnitude and direction remains constant. So, if it is known that the external magnetic field is zero everywhere in this region, can you conclude that the external electric field is zero also? Let me drop. And if it is known that the external electric field is zero everywhere, can you conclude that the external magnetic field is zero also? Could you explain that in your answer?
Should I explain the Zeeman effect? The radio astronomers can measure the strength of a by recognizing the Zeeman effect. Should I explain that one to you, Wes? Go ahead.
Well, it would be good if you mentioned that to the public.
Okay, Mr. Zeeman recognized the fact that every molecule has very characteristic wavelengths at which it emits. A hydrogen, a free hydrogen atom emits a signal at 1420 megacycles. So you set up your radio telescope and you listen at 1420 megacycles and you aim your telescope with a high gain antenna at various places in space, like they did at the Ohio University radio telescope, the Ohio Wesleyan radio telescope. That's the so-called big ear of Dr. John Krause, W-H-J-K. And I visited that site, as did Mel, K-2-K-E-Y. He visited that site also at a different time. Anyhow, with that great big radio telescope tuned to 1420 megacycles, as you aim it into various places in space, you measure how much 1420 megacycles you're seeing. That tells you how much hydrogen is in that particular point in space. And you can also measure the Doppler shift. If the 1420 megacycles is a little bit higher, that means the hydrogen molecules are moving toward you. And if it's a little bit lower, they're moving away from you. Okay. So each molecule has got a characteristic frequency at which it tends to emit when it's at a particular temperature. Let me drop. Now, in a laboratory is where I think they first discovered that when you have a heated up substance and it's emitting a particular wavelength, and then you submit that substance while it's emitting, you submit it to a magnetic field, you'll find out that the peak of radiation, the frequency, you're making a spectrum analyzer plot. Frequency is horizontal, amplitude is vertical, and you get this Gaussian shaped curve around the center of radiation of that particular molecule. And now you submit it to a magnetic field, and the peak of radiation becomes two individual peaks. One of the peaks moves up in frequency, one of the peaks moves down in frequency. By the separation of those two peaks, you can tell what the magnetic field magnitude was. So here you are plotting the gas of your favorite galaxy that's 3 million light years away, and you're plotting the amount of radiation of some particular organic molecule, we'll say, and you're plotting the magnitude, the strength of the signals you're getting from that molecule at various portions of that galaxy. And while you're looking at that particular portion of the galaxy, at that particular frequency region, you see that the frequency of emission of your favorite molecule has got two separate peaks to it. And by the separation of those two peaks, you know how strong is the local magnetic field in that portion of that galaxy 3 million light years away. In my example, radio astronomers have been doing that for some time. That's called the Zeeman effect. And now the exact mechanism as to how that happens, again, I'm pretty sure that the moving charge of those electrons, let me drop. The moving charge of those electrons in the presence of the magnetic field, which is exerting a force on them, and that force creates some kind of a disturbance to their orbits, which increases and decreases their normal frequency of emission. That's what I think is going on. And so once you know the word and you can come up with the right spelling of it, and you Google that word, guarantee if we Google the word Zeeman effect, there's got to be a beautiful Wikipedia site that's going to give you a much better explanation than I did. So maybe that's part of what you were just asking, Wes, although maybe it's off to one side. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay, N2XJN. Well, the answer should be that the charged particle in the electric field experience a force, F equals QE,
right,
okay? And so its motion will change. And that's actually Newton's first law. So consequently, if the motion of the particle remains unchanged, there can be no force. Therefore, there is no electric field. And to the second part of my question, the response should be, if the electric field is zero, we cannot conclude that the magnetic field is zero. So if the charged particle is traveling parallel to the lines of the magnetic field, it does not experience a force. And so it is, its motion remains unchanged. So the magnetic field is either zero or parallel to the motion of the charged particle. Do you agree with that? That's what I'm saying.
Yes, I do. And that is the theory of operation of a traveling wave tube. A traveling wave tube has got this helix that's inside of the vacuum envelope. The magnetic field is set up parallel to the axis of that helix. The electrons traveling down the center of the helix in the vacuum envelope, you want them to be carefully aligned so that they travel down the center of the helix but do not deviate off to one side and touch the wire of the helix, otherwise it'll burn it up. So you make this real strong, highly focused magnetic field, which is in turn generating a very strong electric current flow of electrons, electron current flow down the center of the traveling wave tube, and now you inject a small signal at the beginning, the first couple of turns of that helix. That in turn creates an electrostatic charge on that helical winding, which has the effect of speeding up and slowing down some of those electrons that are in that beam flowing down the center of the helix. And after a certain drift space, certain number of centimeters downrange, the speeded up electrons and the slowed down electrons now form themselves into bunches. So you have charged bunches of electrons, and then when they get to the last few turns of the helix, that moving charge of bunches of electrons couples energy into the last few turns of helix, and out comes this huge signal. A good traveling wave tube can have an octave of bandwidth, can have 35 and 45 decibels of gain all in one tube, and depending on the design of the tube, it might have 1,000 watts of power output in the CW mode. I have worked on tubes like that. Beautiful. So what that tube is proving to me is that if the magnetic field is parallel to the velocity of the electric...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If the magnetic field is parallel to the velocity vector of the electrons, then yes, there is no interaction. So any electrostatic field in the vicinity of an electron will deflect it. But only the magnetic fields that have a right angle component to the velocity factor create an interaction. So if you have an electron that's traveling in a straight line and it looks like nothing is affecting it, you can be pretty sure there's no electrostatic field, but you're not positive whether or not there is a magnetic field. Into XJN, K2RIW.
Into XJN. Okay. Now, I spoke this week with Glenn, and I asked him to repeat again his beautiful explanation of certain things that are important to me with my experiments. And I would like you guys just to comment that. You have a toroidal ferrite, and you have a one winding on it. That winding is connected to the generator. Now, because we do not know what is the impedance of that winding, so you may have a mismatch of the impedance. Now, that will be our input coil. So we're feeding that with 10 volts and let's say 0.2 amp. Now, what we have on that ferrite is that we have the output coil, and the output coil has is BFLR, doesn't matter if it's BFLR or not BFLR, has the capacitor in parallel connected to that coil, and also there is a load in parallel connected to that variable capacitor. Now, how would then the impedance match between the primary and the generator be affected by me changing the capacitance on that parallel circuit that is the output coil? Back to you, sir.
Yeah, there were a couple of words that you used that need a little bit of clarification. I'm going to try to give you that clarification. Assume I am winding myself a power transformer. That's going to work on 50 or 60 hertz. And if I'm a smart person, I'm going to put enough turns in the primary commensurate with the cross-sectional area and the kind of iron that's in the transformer core.
We don't have an iron, Dick. We have a ferrite.
Doesn't matter. It's a magnetic material. If I'm making a transformer where I desire tight coupling between the primary winding and any other winding, most likely I am not making an air core coil. I'm making an air core transformer. I'm making a transformer that is going to have some kind of a ferromagnetic material, ferrite, iron, slabs, tape winding, whatever. There's going to be some kind of an iron-like material because the iron-like material couples magnetic fields many times faster and more efficiently than air. Air is a nice linear material, but magnetic field really doesn't like going through air. It much rather would go through a magnetic material. Let me drop. So I've gone through this exercise. I had to wind way back in the dark ages of 1956, 58. I made my own power transformers for a transistorized power supply because I couldn't go to Lafayette Electronics. Radio Shack didn't exist yet. Arrow Electronics didn't have it. You wanted a transformer that had 15 volts AC center tapped output for the secondary winding because you want to make a 12 volt power supply. You couldn't buy it. I had to wind my own. So you put enough turns on the primary winding of your magnetic core so that it has enough inductance so that just the pure inductive reactance of the primary at 60 hertz, in my case, was high enough that it wasn't a significant amount of current. I wanted some minimum amount of inductance. Now that I've got that right amount of inductance, the right number of millihenries or henries in the primary winding, that means when I put the 110 volts, 120 volts, 60 cycle wave there, the total current through the primary all by itself is a small number. I could talk about the impedance of that winding, but in theory, it's a pure inductance. I now wind a secondary winding on there, and I choose the right turns ratio so that secondary winding gives me whatever voltage that I want. Let me drop. And if I for a second ignore the straight capacitance between the turns of primary and secondary and between the turns of the secondary, when I added the secondary winding and I repeat the experiment of measuring primary current when I apply 110 volts to it at 60 cycles, in theory nothing happens. When I start putting a load across that secondary winding, now things start happening. Depending on what load resistor or load capacitor I put on the secondary winding, assuming now that I've got very little leakage reactance, in other words, my primary and secondary are wound really on top of each other and I've got high quality iron or high quality ferrite such that I've got a tight coupling between the primary and the secondary. Now, if I had a 1-to-1 turns ratio, for an example, between primary and secondary, and if I now put a 100 ohm resistor on that secondary winding, the primary winding will look pretty close to a 100 ohm load plus a small shunt reactance, the original shunt reactance that was there. So the impedance you see on the primary of a good design of a transformer is primarily determined by what load I put on the secondary winding, how many turns there are to the secondary winding, how tight is the coupling between the two. So when the transformer is used in the ideal environment, the load I see on the primary, 95% of that is determined by what I put on the secondary. That was my belief. That was my philosophy. I designed a transformer with that philosophy, and it did the job. It's not the whole story, but for me, that simplistic way of looking at it, it did work. Now, Glenn has designed a whole lot of transformers. He knows a lot more about this. Let's have Glenn add to what I just said. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
And question, Dick, WS2N.
Okay, Glenn first, and then John, and then Paul in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, Dick, you explained it quite eloquently, and I really don't have a lot to add to it, other than just that the ferrite material or the magnetic material that's used inside the winding has higher permeability. And that higher permeability basically keeps the lines of flux within the path length between the two windings very uniform. So that's one of the nice reasons of having windings around ferrite. But I'm going to pass it right back to you, Dick, and pick up Paul in between, and we'll take this, I guess, step by step, because the circuit that Wesley's describing comes in quite a few parts with a spark gap. So back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, well, I would like to just add that my ferrite is made from two halves of the ferrite yoke from the deflection yoke of the TV. I have quite a few questions about that. Now, the primary is on one half, the secondary is on the other half. That's what I was interested in. So it looks like by adding the capacitance to the secondary with the load on it, I'm actually tuning the impedance of the primary to the point of its match. Back to you.
Now, we've got to be careful, Wes. When you just broke in there without waiting for the beep, you then should have stood by until you got a beep, because if we time out the machine, the guys on the Eastern machine and the guys on the Internet don't hear what we're saying. And once you start getting a spark gap across that secondary, life's going to get complicated. But let's see what John wants to, what Paul wants to ask first. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick, I thought about this when you were talking about the, Millie Henrys and all of that. And just a sidebar of this topic. Has there ever been an instrument that has been developed to measure, Henrys or, Millie Henrys? You know, we talk about that quite a bit, but, or is it, when you're looking for, how many millihenries you have, is that just something that's just derived mathematically, from other measurements? Is there really a machine, maybe a laboratory machine, that could actually show you that, where a needle goes moving along or a digital number comes onto a screen that says, oh, you have this many millihenries? Back to you, Dick. WS.
Oh, absolutely. You go into a good laboratory 25 years ago, 30 years ago, you'll see something called an LCR meter. It's got two great big, GR plug-like terminals to it. You put your unknown across it, and if it's a coil, you can measure the series resistance by going to the resistance mode. If it's a coil, you go to the inductance mode. It'll tell you how many millihenries or henries it's got, and you select what frequency. Because every real transformer has a certain amount of inductance which is frequency sensitive. I may design that transformer, in my case, to operate very nicely at 60 hertz. I may decide that under working load, there's going to be an ampere of flow on that primary at 120 volts. I'm going to put 120 watts into this thing because it's the transformer, when it's fully loaded, is going to draw 1 ampere RMS at 120 volts RMS on that primary. So 1 ampere flows when the transformer is loaded. When the transformer is unloaded, I would like the current that flows to be something very small, maybe 10 milliamperes. Now, 10 milliamperes on 120 volts is, let me think now, that's 100 to 1, that's something like 10 kiloohms. If the inductive reactance of the primary was 12,000 kiloohms, then with 120 volts on the primary, something very close to 10 milliamps of current would flow. That tells me how much inductive reactance I want. Since it's at 60 hertz, I go to the right formula. Inductive reactance equals 2 pi FL. That tells you how many henries has got to be in that coil. And once I know something about the magnetic material, let me drop. Dick? Yeah, the person who said Dick, I'll pick you up in a second. Once I know how many, how much inductive reactance I want, that's a certain number of Henrys. Once I know how many, how much magnetic material I've got, that turns out to be some given number of turns on that Fermi winder to give me that inductive reactance. So there's fairly simple measurements, there's fairly simple calculations once you understand the principle of operation. The person who said Dick, it sounded like Alan. Was that you, Alan? KC2RFN, K2RW?
Hey, Dick, M2EO. I was just on the telephone with Patty, but I missed some of that. $25 or $20, a digital LCR meter, made in China, digital readout, couple of leads, you can read the capacitance, you can read inductance. I can read down to about 4 or 5 millihenries. Much lower than that, it starts to make mistakes. But it's very, very accurate from what I've seen. Coils that are a certain value, I read them, and they're right on the money. I wish I could tell you where we bought it from. Maybe Hal K6DPZ remembers. But we bought it from a company on the West Coast, bringing them in from China. LCR meter, like $25.
I know that you can buy something that looks like a digital voltmeter. I own one, which also has a capacitance function to it. So it's got an ohmmeter scale, and it's got a capacitance scale. There's probably a version of a digital voltmeter, which will also measure inductance. But what I was starting to say, though, is that depending on the thickness of the laminations of my EI core of this 60 hertz transformer that I was winding, if I make the measurement of it as primary inductance at 60 hertz, I'll come up with a particular reading. If I made the measurement at 400 hertz, and then 4 kilohertz, and then 40 kilohertz, I'll start getting very different numbers of Henry or millihenry. The number of millihenry will probably go down as I go up in frequency, because if I haven't used fine enough laminations to that primary core, I'm starting to build up eddy currents. The eddy currents really means that the primary winding thinks it's seeing a secondary winding with a load across it. That's sort of the way it behaves. So when you measure the LCR meter inductance of a transformer, it really has to be defined for a particular frequency. So if you're winding an IF can, you might want to measure that inductance at 455 kilohertz. If you're winding a 60-cycle transformer, 60 hertz transformer, you're going to want to measure the frequency there. A real good LCR meter has a whole lot of ranges to it, and you can dial in what frequency it uses to excite your device under test, because the frequency matters. In the case of a capacitor, good capacitors don't change much versus frequency. But when it comes to inductors, air core inductor, no problem. A ferrite wind transformer or a EI lamination transformer, inductance definitely changes as a function of winding. Let me drop.
Could be an incremental bridge stick.
Okay, what I think John is telling us is that if you buy the right meter, it can even tell you the rate of change of inductance versus frequency. Is that what an incremental bridge can do for you, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
The incremental bridge that I have, the general radio, you can dial in a frequency and at a specific voltage also. So you can test your transformer at its operational frequency. And that's great when you're doing like a 50-60 combination transformer. Works very well.
And also, you can do it on the load, which is not very much a common technique.
Yeah, some of these meters will measure the inductance, or they'll measure the total impedance characteristic as you put various loads on the secondary. So you could really simulate the real world. But now, in the case of many transformers that we wind, the core comes apart in various ways. In the case of a 60-cycle transformer, you've got EI laminations. In the case of ferrite transformers, sometimes they're in the form of an upper cup and a lower cup, and you wind the primary on one and the secondary in the other, and then you slap them together. In the case of Wes's situation, the ferrite core that was around the neck of the gun assembly of a cathode ray tube comes apart into two pieces. If the manufacturer did a real good job of lapping the joints, in other words, if the smoothness of the ferrite in the gap is smooth enough so that when you put them together there is essentially no air left, it is possible to make a piece of ferrite lap almost like it is one single piece of ferrite, and you wound the wire on there as if it was a toroid. It's possible to do that. And the advantage of having it in two separate pieces is it's easier to wind the winding, and you have a way of tuning it if you want to. You can put a piece of paper between those joints, making a kind of an air gap, which will change the amount of inductance of both the primary and the secondary. You can tune the inductance by tuning that air gap when you've got it. But if it's a real good manufacturer and nicely smooth joint, and you put it together with no air between, the fact that there's two separate sections might almost be a wash, and that may problem might go away if it was designed with enough quality. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay. N2XJN. Before I go further with my questioning about this particular structure, question for you. In certain computer monitors, electrons are accelerated through a potential difference of, let's say, 10,000 volts towards the screen. Of course, this is a question to John as well. What is the maximum deflection if the electrons experience if the Earth's magnetic field is 0.6 G? Is it negligible?
First of all, most cathode ray tubes for monitor service and television service, I think, have something much closer to 25,000 volts. A 10,000 volt tube would be a very small cathode ray tube used on a miniature oscilloscope. These great big display cathode ray tubes, more like 25,000 volts. And back in the days, we used to have a failure of the 1B3 rectifier on the flyback circuit of a television set. Once that filament wasn't being properly heated, or the tube was a little bit gassy so that the voltage dropped down, not only would the screen become dimmer, but the screen would balloon. In other words, the electrons moving through the gun assembly, when the voltage on the screen is a lower voltage, they start going into a greater deflection. It's very similar to what happens with a person going around a circular racetrack. The centrifugal force increases very rapidly as you increase the velocity of the vehicle going around a circular track. By the same token, when you've got electrons moving at a higher velocity through the gun assembly, because the voltage is higher, it takes a greater amount of force to deflect them. They act like they are more stiff, if you know what I mean. They're less subject to deflection when you move them faster. Even though the higher speed gives them a greater force, the deflection requirement goes up square law. Now, when the Earth's magnetic field is interfering with a cathode ray tube, back in the old days, when you used to do a so-called convergent alignment on the cathode ray tube of a color television set, and you did a very careful alignment, you were doing it in the presence of the Earth's magnetic field. If the owner of that house came along and decided that, hey, I had my television set in the northwestern corner of the room, and I want to move it to the northeast corner of the room, he's changed the orientation of the television set. If he was a critical television watcher in, let's say, 1970, he would have to call the technician back to do a reconvergence adjustment, because now the colors on the screen would start shifting because the Earth's magnetic field was affecting it. That's the old-fashioned three-gun type cathode ray tube for color television. Let me drop.
I have a comment on that.
But you take the so-called modern Trinitron tube, which everyone believes that Sony invented it. Sony licensed it from the original inventor. But you take the Trinitron tube, It is nowhere near as sensitive to Earth's magnetic field. But I do remember people complaining about the fact that when they moved the television set and changed its orientation, that in theory, if you were a critical watcher, reconvergence is required. I wonder if you were involved in some of those convergence adjustments, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Well, absolutely, Dick, especially manufacturers, basically. What had happened on the older tubes, 70-degree deflection angles and greater, when you moved the set, it wasn't a question of convergence, it was a question of adjustment of purity due to contamination of the shadow mask, which was a metal ferrous product that had the aperture holes for the beam to pass through to strike the right colored phosphor. That would become magnetically contaminated, and you would see, if you looked at a red field, you'd see a little blue, a little green in there. The convergence basically stayed in lock, but you did have to decouse the set, absolutely.
Okay, so the color purity, yeah. The first step of doing a so-called convergence alignment of an old-fashioned trigun color CRT television set, you would first turn on just the red gun and do all the adjustments required that you have pure red on the screen, no other color across the whole screen, uniform brightness, uniform red across the screen. You do the same thing with the green and the blue. So the first adjustment was color purity of the three individual guns. And local magnetic field will shift that beam compared to those particular apertures. And I think you're saying when you try to turn on white, red, green, and blue are just the right ratio, so you get white, it wouldn't be white. Or while you're looking at red, is what you were saying, you might see some green or blue. Back to you, John, for some more comments on that. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Oh, absolutely right, Dick. You would do your static convergence usually first, get it roughly in the area so that you had all of the apertures lined up. Then you would do your purity. It was a back-and-forth motion. And then once you got the purity set, then you could go ahead and do your dynamic convergence. And that's basically the way it went down. And at one time, sets had to be converged on delivery or coming out of the factory. They would do an alignment, but it was a pretty rough alignment originally. I'm talking back in, like, 54 and 56. Those sets were horrors that converged, and it got better and better. Then, you know, they started with pin-cushioning, went to the rectangular tubes, and then, of course, they went from 70-degree deflection to 110, which made convergence even more difficult. Motorola had a lot of trouble with that.
What was the brand name of your dot bar generator that you used for convergence? And did you usually do that on, let's say, channel 2? I guess you would tune it to a channel that you know is blank, channel 3. I'm guessing you align your dot, your crosshatch dot bar generator for channel 3, tune the television set to channel 3, and then proceeded with all those motions. What brand name? How many dollars? How long did you keep it? How many have you owned? Tell us about that convergence generator, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Well, when we were working for Sylvania out in Batavia, New York, we had to have the Hickok, the large Hickok, and it covered channels 3, 4, and 6. We could go to any one of those channels depending on what was active in your area. Usually 3 was the most popular. But the Hickok was quite a large instrument. It was about 24 inches by 30 inches, and it was about 8 inches thick. Real suitcase.
How heavy was that to carry, John?
About 40 pounds thick.
So it's about the size, about the weight of a modern-day cathode ray tube display device, a 15-inch display. That's roughly how heavy was your alignment generator. And you had another great big box full of tubes and tools and whatever. When you walked into a house to do service, something on a handle on each arm as you walked through that front door, John?
Oh, yeah, Dick. When we were sent by the factory to help them out, we had to have the full truck. We had every part, every item, including CRTs available on demand. And we had what they call DSM. We had field scrap privileges. We could just order a new set right out of Batavia and have it sent to you. Because some things they had, one thing